must be the one to show me signs so subtle. I think you ought to spend more time inside my bubble, looking for a heartache like you. I'm looking for a heartache like you.
When Nashville mainstays Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale write a song, usually their voices aren't the ones featured on the final take. That's because they both worked as producers, songwriters, and sidemen for some of rock and country music's biggest stars, Elvis Costello, Emmylou Harris, the Dixie Chicks, George Strait, to name just a few. But their latest project, an album of duets that were inspired by male duos like the Everly Brothers and Flattin' Scruggs, puts both Miller and Lauderdale in the front of the mix. Buddy and Jim is now available from New West Records, and I'm very pleased that it brings Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah. I read that you met in New York City in the 80s. When did you first begin working together?
Well, we met in New York in 1980. 80. Yeah. We both moved up here. I moved from Austin, Texas, which might seem strange, for the music scene up here, and Jim moved from...
I went from North Carolina to Nashville. Mm-hmm. And then came up here.
And then you both went back to Nashville?
No, we spent several years up here.
We did. There was a great music scene. I mean, I'm sure there still is now, but for country music and roots music, there was a great scene happening here in the early 80s and probably continuing on, too, with clubs like the Lone Star Cafe and City Limits.
And we have our own stars like Alison Krauss and others. So mm-hmm. This album features two-part vocal arrangements on pretty much every part of every song. Did you just find yourself being able to harmonize easily?
We've sung together for a long time. I mean, we've been singing together pretty much since 1980, on and off.
And it's funny, Buddy and I have known each other for so long that we kind of think alike. We have some of the same instincts. And when we're speaking, sometimes, like, I'll say something and he'll finish
his sentences. You never know. We just started. That didn't work
You've
out
You've done
that
well. Before, but
this is the first time.
We rehearsed it, though, right before it came in, and it didn't work out.
But so you didn't trade verses. You decided to do most of this in
I love
two-part
harmony.
Yeah,
I mean, I just think two-part harmony is so strong. When you put the third part in there, it sweetens it up. It kind of – and also you lose the freedom because you have to learn three parts, and three parts can't move around, I think. Like two parts, you got some freedom to move around, which we do when we're singing on the record and live, and we can change it up every night. When you got three parts, you're stuck with those three parts.
Mm-hmm. And we wanted this record to be kind of a mixture of brother or duet singers like the Louvin Brothers or Johnny and Jack.
Everly Brothers.
The Everly Brothers.
Sam and Dave
and people like that, too.
Because you've also dabbled in soul music over the years in both of your careers.
Yes.
Does all the music wind up becoming... the same on some level? I mean, when you're producing a country song, obviously you're looking for a sound that's different than a soul sound, but there are certain things that are constant in everything, aren't
there?
That's
right. There is a thread with all of that kind of music, from bluegrass to R&B to soul to country.
They all come from the same part of the country.
That's right. They do, and mm-hmm. there is an obvious thread. I mean, I produced a record on Solomon Burke, one of his last records before he passed away, and he wanted to make a country-type record, but it wasn't that much different than his other records. He cut more country songs in his career in the 60s than you know, probably a lot of country singers were.
Mm-hmm. I've spoken to gospel singers, black gospel singers, who said that when they would drive from program to program, turn on the radio, they'd wind up hearing country music, and so that's why they sang songs like Great Speckled Bird, which really came out of the white tradition, and then you hear Elvis and Johnny Cash sing gospel music, and they're doing almost note for notes from Sister Rosetta Tharpe. So there was a lot of cross-fertilization.
Absolutely.
Didn't you originally intend this to be an album of cover songs?
That comes up a lot, yeah.
That does.
But most of them are originals.
I'll let Buddy finish my
sentence with that. Is that what you, that didn't?
Yes.
Anyway, yeah, I wanted it to be. I'm a big fan, especially of Johnny and Jack. I just think they have so many – it's just an unmined, bucket of great, great songs. And I love their singing, and they have humor and heart. And I thought, let's do a record, call it Buddy and Jim Sing Johnny and Jack, mostly because we only had 3 days to make this record.
That was a time constraint because of what?
Both of our schedules are really nuts. Jim's out doing a lot of dates, writing a lot. I've been doing – a lot of studio work and producing songs for this TV show on, called Nashville, in Nashville. So we just had, we looked for 3 days that we could work together and a few hours before that.
Well, the two of you are professionals and you probably know how to get past all of the things that that take up so much time for other people. I'm sure that helped. Did you go in with a pretty good idea of just what you were going to do?
We did. We met, actually just had a couple of pre-production meetings and talked about some older cover songs and then some of the revisiting some things we had written in the past. And then in order to write some new things, I asked Buddy if he had any scraps of songs, ideas, because in the past that's the way we had worked before. And so I was really gung-ho about us doing some writing together for the record.
And Jim's got an amazing gift at being given a scrap, literally just something you wouldn't think of as having song potential, and turning it into a great song.
Well, it also helps to have work with other musicians who don't take up a lot of time.
That's so right.
I suspect you worked with people you've worked with many times in the past.
Yeah. And you know, the records that we love, too, I think were made quickly. The records I love the most were probably didn't take more than a few days to make. Now it's, you know, records may take months up to, you know, years with some folks, but...
And why do people need that many takes? Usually the best energy is in the first, second, or third mm-hmm. take, isn't
it? I think
it?
People have just gotten crazier and self-indulgent.
Yeah.
It shouldn't take
overthink
too long.
Overthink it, maybe.
Yeah.
But Buddy, you know, one of the reasons why it went so smoothly is he has developed into being one of the most in-demand producers out there. I mean, he is a... And he's a guitar player's guitar player, a singer's singer, and a producer's producer. And he's very justifiably risen to the ranks of today's, you know, great producers. So he really, it was a breeze, really, to lay this down. We didn't have any problems, no draw.
But you're producing yourselves, which is different than
well. He produced it though. He is the
well. We're both, you know, I think, really involved. But you get it. We cut it in my house, which isn't like a studio. It's just a lot of junk in a house. But it's a comfortable place where, you know, musicians can feel like they can just create. And
fairly recently, we had Richard Thompson here. He produced his last album.
Yeah, I produced his record
in your house,
at my house. Yeah, and Sean Colvin's. New record, and Carolina Chocolate Drops new record too, and a bunch of other things.
And is it okay to say about the Band of Joy?
Oh, Robert Plant. Yeah,
that guy, Robert Plant.
Been recording a lot too with him. It's just a room where, you know, instead of looking at a blank white wall, you're looking out windows at birds, and your brain can go somewhere else while you're playing. And I think it maybe helps, maybe not. There's birds on every track I cut in there.
It's very relaxed and comfortable and bright in there. It's really nice.
In his review of the record for the New York Times, John Perella said that Buddy and Jim is far less metaphysical than the albums that you make with your wife, Buddy, the singer-songwriter Julie Miller. What do you think he was referring to? Lyrical content?
I think lyrical content. I think when we went into this record, it's less metaphysical or probably than a lot of Jim's records too.
And she co-wrote a number of the songs on the record, including this standout track, That's Not Even Why I Love You.
There's too many things like this.
That song is an expression of love, but what makes it an exception from the others is that it's mostly the others are mostly about the problems that you face with love. The arrangements on all of them are mostly upbeat. I assume that was intentional, even if the song had a kind of a a bittersweet lyric.
I think so. I think we just ended up making and probably wanting to make a fun record. I never really made a record that's kind of like fun and up. Have you, Jim?
Not really. No.
But that last song was an example of a scrap that Jim took. You know, my wife maybe wrote the first couple lines of that song. I had some chord changes in a melody, and that would have just stayed there and not been anything had Jim overnight turned it into a really good song.
How many songs are like that? I'd imagine that songwriters are often just writing down little scraps. They're in a hotel, and mm-hmm. something occurs to them, and then it just never goes anywhere.
A lot of mine never go anywhere. I think a lot of Jim's go someplace.
Well, because you're good with the scraps.
I have a lot of scraps on my own that I could start a food company. I have so many scraps that I haven't finished.
Are these songs mostly autobiographical, or does constantly working in the Nashville scene teach you how to write songs that, that just will have some kind of hit potential?
I think, if anything, the songs certainly resonate with me. I don't know if they're autobiographical, but, you know, a song's got to mean something to me to want to record
yeah.
it.
Yeah, like that's
the wobble might be autobiographical.
Did you find any creative advantages from working on this really tight schedule? You then took only 2 days to mix it.
Right.
I think so, and I think, like, with the songs that we wrote for the record, you know, we just didn't have the time to overthink it, and it was a fun challenge. Sometimes when I'm working on my own records or trying to write something for somebody else, there's this – it for me, it's not really – it's kind of more of a self-imposed deadline, but for some reason it gets to be this real uncomfortable, high-pressure, tense, stressful thing. And for some reason with this record, even though we had a real deadline, it just had a good flow to it.
I'm talking with Jim Lauderdale and Buddy Miller, their latest CD, Buddy and Jim, duets. I read that the inspiration for the opening track, I Lost My Job of Loving You, came from a guitar riff that Buddy showed you?
That's right. That was, I think, the first scrap.
That was another scrap, yeah, that was really next to nothing that he turned into, I think, a real cool song.
And so late at night before we started, or actually I might have said, hey, I think I've got this title,
yeah,
I Lost My Job of Loving, and you do like it, and he liked it, and so that... It all just came – a lot of times with my stuff, it takes forever for me to finish something lyrically. But with Buddy and I started out our writing relationship with him giving me melodies. I usually work the other way around. And so and in the past, there have been several songs that Buddy has given me those, and it took a long time. But this just came together real quickly.
Well, what happens when you're writing for other performers? Do they ask you to write a song for them, or do you just take those scraps and say, oh, gee, this sounds like something Steve Earle might be interested in?
Well, in Nashville, it's mostly, for me, in the country market, and George Strait has done the most songs, and so his producer or somebody from his label or manager will say, hey, George is going in. So I will try to write something alone or with somebody else, but oddly enough, they rarely get recorded. And sometimes it's the kind of offbeat songs that I'll think, well, I might as well throw this at him. I've tried everything else. Nothing is stuck. And then, oddly enough, he'll take those that I wouldn't imagine him doing. And when I try to write for other artists in the past, too, it usually just doesn't. Even when I think, hey, I've written a hit song with so-and-so for this artist, they end up passing on him a lot.
But still, this is an anomaly. In the old days, you had the Brill Building, and
right.
And you had the songwriting teams, Lieber and Stoller, et cetera, and then the performers who sang their songs. And then along came the Beatles, and everybody was a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. Nashville is the last place where the old style, the old approach, the Gershwins write a song and then you know, Emmylou Harris winds up singing it.
That's right. Well, you know, Nashville is, and I was lucky enough to live in the building that Doc Pomus lived in here in Manhattan, a great...
No, I know he was a guest on our show once.
And Nashville, Buddy and I, you know, we've mentioned that kind of the analogy of the Brill Building, and Nashville is kind of like Brill Town.
It really is. It really is. People are moving there every day. Great writers from all over the world. I mean, it's just amazing. And players and singers. But the songwriting thing, especially while I've been working on this TV show, because it's song-based, we probably have 6 songs a week. And we're drawing on a lot of the writers in town, and I've just been amazed how great they are.
Now, I've been talking about you as songwriters and producers, but you also have worked as sidemen. You've done tours with Elvis Costello, Lucinda Williams, among many others. Do you play differently when you're working for somebody else than when you're doing something like this? One critic called you kind of throwbacks.
Who said that?
Well, no, I think it meant as a compliment.
I know, I'm teasing. Well, now for me, working with Lucinda or Elvis Costello, it's harmony singing, just rhythm guitar playing, very, you know, mixed way in the background, and harmony singing. Now, Buddy is a major, more because of his great lead playing and singing. He's more of
it's been a stretch for me. I mean, I love it. I love everything about it. Going from working with Emmylou Harris to Robert Plant is a whole different thing, but I grew up like everybody did, listening to all kinds of music. I mean, I went to high school near here, and I would go to the Fillmore East and see, you know, I saw Led Zeppelin's first show at the Fillmore when they were opening for Iron Butterfly.
And then down the block was the 5 Spot.
Yeah, well, there you go.
In addition to your studio work together, you co-host a radio show on Sirius XM called Outlaw. On the Outlaw Radio?
Outlaw Channel, yeah. Outlaw Country.
You interview musicians, so...
That is a dream come true for me. I love it.
Yeah.
We had, just last week, we had just all these folks living in Nashville, we can have them. We had Dan Penn in, great songwriter, Muscle Shoals.
Who wrote so many classics and was there, you know, during the... Muscle Shoals and American Studio period.
And really, I imagine that they're more open with you because you're peers.
And they come in, they sing, they tell a lot of stories, yeah. And it's a blast.
My guests have been Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale. Their latest project together is Buddy and Jim, available on New West Records. Thank you so much.
Thank
you.
Really
Thank
you.
A lot of fun talking with you.
It's been great.
Thanks.
Stay.